Now, we're from America, but this isn't New York City, or the Windy City, or Sin City, and we're certainly no one's Emerald City.
This is the Motor City, and this is what we do.
You remember that Chrysler ad from the 2011 Super Bowl? In it, Detroit native Eminem helped promote his hometown and Chrysler's highly effective Imported from Detroit campaign, a campaign made possible by its share of the roughly $80 billion taxpayer bailout of the auto industry. Where are we today, 4 years after what some call government motors? Joining us now is Bill Vlasic, Detroit bureau chief for the New York Times and author of the book Once Upon a Car, The Fall and Resurrection of America's Big Three Automakers, GM, Ford, and Chrysler. It's out this month in paperback, and we welcome you to the show, Bill Vlasic.
Oh, thanks, Ann.
You said that in writing this book, you wanted people to understand how dire the situation had become back then and how close the auto industry was to going out of business. Let's revisit those days. Just how close was it?
Well, this is sort of the reckoning that had been predicted for years in Detroit. Financial obligations and pensions and health care and jobs bank for unpaid workers that they had been carrying like an albatross for decades, too many cars being built for too few customers, layers and layers of bureaucracy, all the criticisms of Detroit, which the companies GM, Ford, and Chrysler managed to sort of sidestep every time with a surge in the market or borrowing money or looking for global expansion in China and elsewhere. It all sort of avoided the rotting of the core, if you will, which was North American operations that were losing billions and billions of dollars year after year. And as a reporter, it was interesting to cover for many years sort of the strategic explanations that General Motors, for example, would give us about how they were becoming more competitive and turning around their business model. But in the spring and summer of 2008, it's like the hull of the ship cracked, and the depths to which GM had fallen were sort of astonishing to people. I remember covering the second quarter earnings in 2008 for GM, and they were announcing yet another restructuring plan, and all the numbers seemed to add up. We're going to raise this much money on Wall Street. We're going to sell assets. We're going to cut jobs. It's all, and we have plenty of cash to make it through. 90 days later, during the third quarter report, GM said they were running out of money. They would not be able to pay their employees and suppliers by the end of the year, and they needed an emergency transfusion of funds just to stay in business. Now, this didn't happen in 90 days. This had taken place over years. But the jig was up, and once GM went to Washington, essentially led the auto industry to Washington for a bailout, all the excuses and all the explanations became very hollow very quickly. And
especially when they arrive in their private jets.
That was also the ultimate blind spot to how they were being perceived. In retrospect, I think General Motors Chairman CEO Rick Wagoner expected to go to Washington and get a big hug and a check from Congress that, oh my goodness, the powerful, important auto industry is in trouble, so therefore, of course, we'll help them out. Instead, he unleashed sort of all this frustration and anger from a variety of different sectors, whether it was environmentalists or anti-union politicians or Southerners who had Honda plants in their states. It just became a kind of a bloodbath of criticism, and in many ways it started the debate: is an auto industry important? Do Americans care if we have an auto industry? And I think that was a turning point. As messy and as ugly as those hearings were, and sort of the bankruptcies that followed, and of course all the political discussion about the wisdom of bailing out these companies. Really, that debate about the relevance and the importance of the industry mm-hmm. was finally on the table.
My guest is Bill Vlasic. He's author and Detroit bureau chief for the New York Times. He's written a book. It's out in paperback this month called Once Upon a Car, The Fall and Resurrection of America's Big Three Automakers, GM, Ford, and Chrysler. To our listeners out there, what did you think of the bailout? Do you think it worked? Do you think it didn't work? And give us a call and tell us why or why not. 614-292-8513. You can email us at allsides@wosu.org, or you can go to our Facebook page or tweet us at WOSU All Sides. But only 140 characters might take more than that to answer that question. So, you know, you mentioned it. You said so, Bill. The auto companies are so pervasive a part of American life, especially for someone like me who grew up in Michigan. They're so big. They're larger than life. It was fascinating to read about the flesh and blood that was running them, or running them into the ground, depending, I guess, on your point of view. Why the narrative about the personalities behind the industry and the bailout?
Well, because in many ways, you have to go to the source and see who was making the decisions and how they got into this situation. And these three companies were all icons in their own right, and they had their sort of distinct corporate personalities. GM was the biggest, the proudest, the strongest, the most arrogant, some people would say. Ford was always sort of in GM's shadow, but sort of imitating and following GM in many respects, but somewhat insulated by this interesting ownership by the Ford family, the descendants of the legendary Henry Ford, controlling the company. And then, of course, Chrysler was kind of like the hyperactive kid, the kid brother of the bunch, you know, tremendous highs and tremendous lows. And I wanted to put some flesh and blood on not only the people who made the decisions, but the people who lost their jobs and paid the price for these companies losing their way. So one thing I try to do is take readers into the assembly plants that closed and how the union and their leadership struggled to preserve jobs while some of the very contracts they had negotiated were the source of a lot of the financial problems that GM and Ford and Chrysler had. And I think I've learned a lot, even though I knew these men who ran these companies pretty well. I learned a lot about how they worked together, how willing they were to change. And change was way, way, way overdue. In some respects, the Ford story is the most provocative one from that angle, because Bill Ford Jr., when I start the book around the 2005-2006 time frame, Ford arguably was in the worst shape of the big three. Chrysler had a parent company in Daimler in Germany with a lot of money. General Motors was far larger with more cash. And Ford looked like the odd man out. But it was Bill Ford Jr., the great-grandson of Henry Ford, who did something sort of extraordinary, admitted he wasn't the best man to run his own family business, reached outside to bring in a gentleman by the name of Alan Mulally from the Boeing company, and forever shattered this myth that an outsider could not succeed in the auto industry, that they couldn't understand it or run these companies.
Because Ford ended up not going back to Washington and survived anyway.
And that was part of that was the company had taken on Mulally's personality when he came in, the outsider who wasn't bound by the old rules. I often said the biggest advantage that Alan Mulally had was he hadn't lived through any of the good times in Detroit. So he wasn't tied to any of the old ways of, volume is everything, and we must keep the plants running at all costs. Mulally took a very fresh approach, borrowed a ton of money early on in his stewardship as CEO, and it turned out that the $23 billion that Ford borrowed saved them from having to ask for a bailout and going bankrupt, and changed the course of history of the big three automakers.
Annie in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Annie.
Hi, I am actually a former automotive engineer. My undergraduate degree was in engineering, and I did work in Ford, GM, and Chrysler plants back in the Detroit area. I'm calling, and basically this is a question for your guest. I was not, given my experience, in support of the bailout at the time, given what I saw when I worked in those plants, and given the inefficiencies that were just built into the system. And it was, I still have so many friends that are in the UAW. These are good people, but the way the labor agreements worked at the time were, just on my own assembly lines, we could have something go wrong. And every time the assembly line is down, every second you're losing money. And it could be one switch in a panel that everybody's standing there, the engineer, the setup person, the machine repairman, the millwright, everybody knows what needs to happen. Mm-hmm. But it couldn't happen unless somebody of the very specific job of electrician, for example, had to be there to make that switch. And if it was his time to be on break, you could sit for 20 minutes.
Those kind of job breakdowns are pretty common in a lot of different organized labor unions. But to what extent?
It's those, not common in the in their counterparts, in their Toyota.
Yes, I know. I understand that. Not in auto labor unions. But I wanted to ask, why don't you ask Bill Vlasic, get to the question.
Has that changed since then? And also, we did the bailout to prevent a bankruptcy, and the bankruptcy still took place 6 months later.
Okay.
How is the bankruptcy that took place different than the one that would have taken place back when they first went in December, January timeframe?
Okay, Annie, hang on, Annie. There's two questions, and we only have about 2 minutes before our next break. So let's get to the first one, Bill Vlasic, as far as the nature of the relationship with the unions and the deal that the automakers have with the unions now versus before.
Well, those are very good observations, mm-hmm. and they're just the tip of the iceberg of the web of entanglements that labor contracts had, set the way that these companies had to operate. The fact is, this was a reckoning for the United Auto Workers as well. In the last 5 years, the UAW has half the number of workers in the three companies that it did before, and so there's been a lot of pain on the blue collar side. And I don't think that the relationship will ever be the same. The fact is, the union has done some things that I never thought they would do. Chief among them, agreeing to a 2-tier wage scale in the plants. I did not think that would happen, but in fact it did, and now that has helped the competitiveness, at least on the cost side. But as far as those work rules and the waiting around and having to have a specific electrician do a specific job, these were years in the making,
right.
And they were loath to give them up. But slowly but surely, I think the union, when confronted with their own survival, has made more accommodations probably in the last 3 or 4 years, some of them under the force of the government's mandate, than they had in the previous 30 years. So I can't say it's gone forever, the old way of doing business, but it's certainly different.
And what about the idea that they had the bailout, but there was still a bankruptcy, but it was different than just letting Detroit go bankrupt?
This was all the most financially prudent way to get GM back on its feet was to take it through this Chapter 11 bankruptcy process and to split off the old GM, they called it, the old assets that nobody wanted. And, of course, that a lot of jobs went with that as well, and come out with what the auto task force called the shiny new GM. I'm not so convinced it's the shiny new GM, but the fact is it's half the size that it was back then. And what I always found interesting was in the old pre-crisis days, we would ask the GM executives, why do you keep the Saturn division? It's not making money. Oh, they can't get rid of Saturn. They can't get rid of Pontiac. It's too important. People care about it too much. Well, guess what? Pontiac, Saturn, Hummer, they all just disappeared, and nobody cared. And the market completely filled the void. So there were a lot of blind spots there, and many of these things without a bankruptcy process would have taken years to accomplish. And instead, it happened so fast, major head spin.
Still with us when we return, Bill Vlasic, author of a book called Once Upon a Car, The Fall and Resurrection of America's Big Three Automakers, GM, Ford, and Chrysler. We'll continue the conversation after this. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
To maintain a healthy discussion, we suggest a steady diet of Talk of the Nation. We'll nourish your brain with everything from cave diving to dolphin encounters, the rise of China, and the latest shenanigans on Capitol Hill. I'm Neil Conan, your daily recommended dose of news, conversation, and serendipity. Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
Talk of the Nation this afternoon from 2 to 4. And it's 44 degrees with some sunshine today, warming up to 62. Partly cloudy tonight, a low of 45. Partly sunny with a chance of morning rain on Wednesday, a high of 57. Support for 89.7 comes from the Columbus Zoo and Aquarium's lecture series, presenting Year of the Bat with leading bat conservation expert Dr. James Eggers on Thursday, October 25th at 7 p.m. at the OSU Fawcett Center. More at columbuszoo.org. And All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Campaign 2012 has been headlined with stories about the economy. Is it on the rebound? Who is responsible? And where does the auto bailout fit into that equation? Presidential hopeful Mitt Romney's Let Detroit Go Bankrupt op-ed has been ready fodder for his opponents, but many Republicans and others still contend the bailout was a bad idea, even unnecessary. Still with us is Bill Vlasic, Detroit bureau chief for the New York Times and author of Once Upon a Car, The Fall and Resurrection of America's Big Three Automakers, GM, Ford, and Chrysler. Thanks again, Bill, for joining us.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Joining us now is James Shirk. He's a senior policy analyst in labor economics at the Heritage Foundation. Welcome to the show, James.
Thank you.
So, James, you've written with Todd Zwicky of George Mason University that the president could have both kept the automakers running and avoided spending so much taxpayer money on the bailout. How would that work?
Well, that's exactly right. I think the president deserves a lot of credit for pushing the automakers into the bankruptcy process. They didn't want to have to file for bankruptcy. They wanted basically flat-up money from the taxpayers, no strings attached, just keep us operating and give us money, and he didn't let that happen. Unfortunately, when the automakers went into bankruptcy, he didn't simply stand back and say, all right, we'll allow the bankruptcy process to unfold as it normally does. Instead, the administration managed the bankruptcy to see to it that particularly the unions got a much better deal than they would normally get in bankruptcy. Normally, when a unionized company goes bankrupt, think of American Airlines right now, If they've got above market wages, if they've got above market benefits, then the bankruptcy courts are going to bring those wages and benefits down to the level of their competitors. And if the company in bankruptcy owes unsecured debt, all the unsecured creditors recover at the same rate. So if you go bankrupt and you owe $2,000 on two different credit cards, you can't give, $200 to Citi and $500 to Chase. Everyone gets the same amount in normal bankruptcy proceedings. But that's not what happened this time. This time, the unions recovered a far, far greater share of the money that they owed in bankruptcy than the other unsecured creditors did. So the unions got about 80 cents on the dollar, whereas the other creditors were getting about 25 cents on the dollar.
What was the justification for that? Because it's so clear that was the case. What was the logical justification?
Well, the justification they gave the bankruptcy court judge was basically, well, we've got an ongoing relationship with these unions and we want to keep them happy, and that if we need basically labor peace. But if you look at the time, there was no way the United Auto Workers was going to go on strike at the time that these companies were going bankrupt. I mean, it beggars belief to imagine that the UAW would have made all their jobs disappear by going on strike at that critical moment. And I think it was largely explained by the fact that the unions were large and politically influential, whereas a lot of the other creditors didn't have the same degree of clout. And so the unions got listened to in the bankruptcy process, and the other people didn't.
Well, they were organized by definition. Bill Vlasic, from where you sat at the time, what did you make of that deal?
Well, I think the bottom line is GM was a failure. GM had failed. They were unable to continue operating the company with the cash that they had on hand. They could not borrow money on Wall Street, which is a fact, at least leading up to the hearings in Washington. Mm-hmm. The financial crisis was in full blaze at that point, and the last place that any Wall Street investment house wanted to lend money was to a broken-down car company like General Motors, which was burning cash billions a month. So there was an awful lot of victims of GM's failure. First and foremost were the stockholders. Used to be a GM, share of GM stock at one time was a thing you passed on to family members. It became worthless, zero. Dealers, workers, not just blue-collar, but thousands of white-collar workers had already been separated from the company. And once President Obama's task force made the decision that bankruptcy was the only way to somehow put GM on a firm financial footing and avoid the dreaded possibility of another bailout down the road, then the horse trading and the decisions on who got what and how we structure this company were made. And you can second guess a lot of them. Fact is, you know, GM came out of bankruptcy 60% owned by taxpayers because all the money that went in, rather than trying to force a sort of shaky GM to pay back debt, they took equity stock in the company as well. Worked to the advantage of General Motors, actually, financially, because they didn't have to pay back debt. However, it's had the hangover of the government Motors ownership. As far as the union was concerned, one of the task force leaders said to me and to others, we needed the workers to build the cars. It may sound simplistic, but I think there was a real fear that if General Motors at any point had to stop making cars, stop buying parts, either because they couldn't afford them or because the process got bogged down, that they could lose any chance of having the kind of momentum in the marketplace that they could survive. And there was a tremendous fear beforehand that a bankrupt auto company, people wouldn't even want to buy their products. That was proven false. But if at any point General Motors had just shut down, whether via a strike or running out of money or just because the negotiation process became so protracted, that could have been very, very detrimental to their long-term opportunity. Because if they stopped making cars and stopped selling them for any period of time, they would have been damaged goods in the marketplace.
And, James Shirk, you're saying that it's highly unlikely that the auto workers would have, you know, struck. But how much did this deal cost the taxpayers, in your estimation?
Well, the Treasury Department estimates the taxpayers are going to lose about $25 billion. Again, this is the Obama administration is estimating it'll cost about $25 billion. But Todd Zwicky and I took a look at the numbers and took a look at basically how much more the union got out of bankruptcy than you would if they'd followed a normal bankruptcy proceeding. And we estimated that it would have saved taxpayers $27 billion if you'd simply had the unions make the same sort of standard concessions that unions are normally required to make in bankruptcy. The entire losses to the taxpayers from the auto bailout came from subsidizing the United Auto Workers compensation. If you'd simply reduced their compensation to market rates and paid back the debts owed to the UAW at the same rates that other creditors collected at, then the taxpayers wouldn't have lost any money. You could have kept the automakers running without losing a dime.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about the big auto bailout of 2008-2009. Questions or comments for our guests, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Nick in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Nick.
Thank you. Appreciate that. You know, and I totally understand the economic considerations for the union, for management, for the nation, everything else, but I think the thing that gets lost in this discussion is that at the end of the day, GM and the other automakers were, in fact, automakers, and the products they made, let's face it, in the marketplace weren't worth buying. And, you know, I purchased my last GM vehicle, and I mean last in every sense of the word, and it was a huge failure. Got rid of it. I'll never buy another one. I'm sitting in my Volkswagen right now, my 2001 Volkswagen with 238,000 miles. My mom has a 2001 Cadillac that with 100,000 miles that is in a horrible state of disrepair. And, you know, I understand the economic considerations. I understand, you know, in a sense what those companies mean to the nation. However, I think the market had spoken, was speaking clearly. And, you know, I'm not sure that after it's all said and done that they can make a product that's worth buying. And so I don't know that... I just don't know that it was worthwhile, and I think that that's the of all the discussions I've ever heard about the auto bailout, I've never heard one about them making cars that aren't worth buying.
And that was before the problem. And yet the top performing stock among the U.S. automakers last quarter turned out to be GM. They must be doing something right.
Well, let's see if those cars are still on the road five years from now, or 6 years from now.
Well, Bill Vlasic, how have they bounced back in terms of just what they create and whether people want to buy it?
Well, there's no question that in all three companies' cases, most of their problems were self-inflicted and poor quality and cars. Lee Iacocca used to have a saying, dump the losers, meaning if somebody didn't want a car, don't build it again. Well, GM not only built it again, they built variations of it and doubled the size. General Motors had no restraints on its production. To them, volume was everything, keeping the plants running at all costs, which in some cases meant building cars that really people didn't want. Quality was spotty. Some of their vehicles did have good quality, particularly their trucks. Well, guess what? That's where they made all their money. But small cars were a loss leader, and most businesses don't put their best efforts into loss leaders because they don't have them. General Motors just never got rid of them. And over time, their reputation was miserable for customer service and reliability compared to the best, compared to the Volkswagens and Toyotas and Nissans of the world. Ford and Chrysler weren't much better. And the fact is, these companies did, at least in GM and Chrysler's case, technically fail. I would respectfully agree with the gentleman from Heritage that these were not normal bankruptcies because these were not normal failures. These companies had everything was made up as it went along by the Auto Task Force and the Obama administration in terms of trying to turn these around and put them on a firm footing. That being said, General Motors as a company with half the size in the U.S. than it was 5 years ago makes better cars than it did before. Ford definitely does and is proving it in the reliability surveys. And a lot of it has to do with nothing. The old saying, "Nothing focuses the mind like a hanging." If your bread and butter is to do, you can't get away with building substandard products any longer, and that there is no wiggle room or cash cushion or just sheer size advantage to fall back on. You have to sweat the details. And I think it's very interesting. We look at Ford, which is a different company because they didn't take the bailout, and I think their leadership has been very inspired in focusing the company on smaller, more fuel-efficient, more reliable cars. And one of the Ford executives said to me, "We're going to try and make the Ford brand cool again." Hmm. And I'm like, "I don't think so. I don't see that. I don't know if that's possible." But lo and behold, slowly but surely, cars like the Focus and the Fiesta are being bought by young people. And so the image of the companies as far as their historical failures, and on the product side, takes a while to get rid of. But they're more competitive now than they have been in any time the 18 years that I've been covering the auto industry. And it's long overdue, and they have a long way to go. But interestingly, even in things like in-car telematics, infotainment.
Right. Very
big. Ford is actually the leader in that.
Very, very big.
So they're doing some things right. It doesn't excuse a lot of the things they did wrong.
Nick, thanks for that call. We appreciate it. James Shirk, was the deal cut with the unions through in the course of that managed bankruptcy? Was that your only criticism of it, or how did you feel about the bailout itself and the rest of the bankruptcy proceedings?
Well, I think one of the central problems with it was exactly that the special interests, were basically handed taxpayer money, that the union members, even after the bailout, are still making about twice what the average American taxpayer is getting in terms of wages and benefits. And yet the bailout was structured in such a way as to prevent their compensation from being cut. I mean, the union sent out a memo to its members basically bragging that, look, your wages are not going to be cut, your health benefits are not going to be cut, your pensions are not going to be cut. That never happens in a bankruptcy. That just doesn't happen in a company with uncompetitive labor costs, a unionized company, a bankruptcy. Normally, everyone has to make sacrifices. Mm-hmm. And in this bankruptcy, the entire reason the taxpayers lost money was because of the fact that the union wasn't asked to make those sacrifices. Now, I think the broader point about the bailout is that in this time around, it looks like it's gone pretty well, but you don't know for sure. I mean, the jury's still out. We'll have to look back in 5 years and say, did GM in fact turn around, or did, as the previous caller suggested, are they continuing to make cars that people don't want to buy, and it's not that high quality? I mean, it's you pour tens of billions of dollars into a company, and of course it's going to do better than it did before. But the real question is GM going to be turned around? Is it going to be making cars that people want to buy? It's better than it was 5 years ago, certainly. Is it better enough to stay viable? Or, as some analysts have suggested, is GM going to be looking for another bailout in another few years? We just don't know yet. I think you can certainly justify the decision to make the bailout, but I think it's too early to crow about it being a success.
Don in Cincinnati, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Don.
Yes, thank you. Mr. Shirk is from the Heritage Foundation. Heritage Foundation is against unions, any unions. And as regards to the taxpayer has been paid back by the company. Now, he happened to not say that either. He said,
"Well,
money.
Well, Chrysler's paid back, but GM has not."
Okay. Well, they are trying. They are making payments. They haven't stopped making payments, and they are still on the road to making payments. And they intend to pay back the taxpayer every money every bit they borrowed.
Don, what was your question?
Just that I would like him to define how he says the taxpayers are not being paid back by the companies that received the loans.
Okay.
And why he wants to attack unions when in Europe. The unions are the best thing they have. They teach people everything. They help them keep their jobs. And in America, the unions are evil. I think he's evil.
Okay, Don, thanks for your call. James Shirk, is it just about a dislike for unions in general?
No, obviously. If I could clarify for the gentleman, that we at Heritage, we don't believe unions belong in government. We think that they obstruct the operations of government. But in the private sector, if workers want to join a union, we certainly believe they have that right and they should be free to do so. But conversely, if they don't want to join a union, they shouldn't be forced into a union, and that there shouldn't be special preferences one way or the other. You shouldn't get special treatment for being in a union, but nor should you be discriminated against or get harmful treatment for being in a union, that it should be a matter of the workers' free choice. And I've got no issue with unions. What I have an issue with is them getting tens of billions of dollars in subsidies from the taxpayers. I mean, if you can earn high wages, that's fantastic. I mean, if your productivity is such that you can earn the $75 an hour and wages and benefits that the UAW members were getting before, I mean, more power to you. It would that everyone could get that much. But when the union contracts to one of the primary factors driving a company into bankruptcy, to then turn around and ask all American taxpayers, many of whom, most of whom, are not making as much as the union members are, to sacrifice in order to prop up the union compensation, that's what I have an issue with. But if the union workers' productivity can justify their high wages, I mean, fantastic. We'd like to see everyone doing that well.
Well, James Shirk, thanks for joining us today to share your thoughts.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
James Shirky, Senior Policy Analyst in Labor Economics for the Heritage Foundation. Coming up, we'll continue the conversation with Bill Vlasic, author of Once Upon a Car, The Fall and Resurrection of America's Big Three Automakers, GM, Ford, and Chrysler. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Start your day with local updates from the award-winning WOSU News team.
Bexley head football coach John Smith has been coaching football for nearly 20 years. He says things have changed a lot since he was a player.
What we were taught, if you blacked out during the hit, it was a great hit. But those are now warning signs and things that kids need to tell a coach or a trainer.
Hear the latest in local and national news on Morning Edition on 89.7 NPR News, your all-day NPR news station.
And time is running out for you to support 89.7 NPR News and register to win an iPad. Our fall membership drive begins on Thursday, just 2 days. And by making your pledge before the start of the drive, you'll be automatically entered to win an iPad. No pledge is necessary, but your support will continue to pay for the programs you enjoy. Entries are only accepted at WOSU.org, so visit WOSU.org right now, make your pledge, and get registered. 44 degrees with some sunshine, warming up to 62 today. Partly cloudy for tonight, a low of 45. Sunshine with a chance of rain Wednesday morning, a high of 57. And stay right here in just about 20 minutes at 11 o'clock. Hour 2 of All Sides begins, and it's Tech Tuesday. That's Tech Tuesday from 11 till noon. And this is 89.7 NPR News.
America's auto industry was built on the backs of blue-collar workers forged from steel and sweat and cast from the idea that hard work and collective thinking would move the industry in this country forward. And then it was 2008. The economy crumbled. Detroit was in trouble, or maybe a better way to put it is still in trouble, and the auto industry was on the verge of absolute collapse. Still with us is Bill Vlasic, Detroit bureau chief for the New York Times and author of Once Upon a Car, The Fall and Resurrection of America's Big Three Automakers, GM, Ford, and Chrysler. And once again, Bill, thanks for staying with us.
Thank you, Ann.
Joining us now is Tom Perriello. He's president of the Center for American Progress Group's Action Fund. It's an independent, nonpartisan education and advocacy organization based in Washington, D.C. Welcome to the show, Tom.
Thank you very much for having me.
One critic of the bailout puts it this way, that it cost $80 billion, roughly $30,000 per auto worker. And given the tone of the particular column in The Washington Post that I read that from, the idea is that they were not worth it. We just heard from James Shirk of the Heritage Foundation, who said that it was the deal that they did cut with the unions in the bankruptcy proceedings that is costing taxpayers some $25 billion. Is it worth it?
Well, James is a smart guy, but I think he knows he's cherry-picking the numbers there. You know, I just got back from a trip across Ohio and Wisconsin and western Pennsylvania, and it has so clearly had an enormous impact on communities and on families. In addition to $60 billion of that already coming back to the taxpayer, we would have seen $97 billion in losses to personal incomes at kitchen tables around the country if we hadn't seen this. We're up to 2.5 million employed in the U.S. auto industry from 2.3 before, while doing some very difficult restructuring. He was saying the unions didn't sacrifice. That's just not true. They took hits on wages, on benefits, both retired and current. And the fact was, this was a case of stepping in at a difficult time when most people in Washington, D.C. thought it was too risky to do. President Obama made that difficult decision, and the recovery has happened faster than just about anyone would have predicted. And so I think that, you know, we've seen manufacturing grow for month after month now. You know, I come from a part of central and southern Virginia where we saw things like our tire factory had dropped hundreds of jobs and is back up above 100% employment. So this was certainly significant. I think President Bush deserves a little credit for having started the process before he left office, and President Obama came in and made the tough choices to get this thing turned around, as did the management, as did the workers. Everybody took a hit, and I think everybody is now seeing the benefit of that.
Let's talk a little bit about what we mean by recovery, what we mean by jobs. Ohio Governor John Kasich told NBC back in June that the auto bailout hadn't created that many jobs in Ohio, about 1,800. But the more liberal group Innovation Ohio reports that more than 17,000 jobs were saved. So is it a matter of semantics? Where is the disconnect? Bill Vlasic, how do you define success? James Shirk already said it's too early to call anything a success, but how would we define it anyways?
Well, I would agree with a comment that was just made that the Obama administration does deserve some credit for believing that GM could be saved. There were an awful lot of skeptics 3 years ago who thought no amount of money could fix General Motors, that this company was a failure. It deserved to either die or be saved based on what it brought to the table, to the country, economically. I actually think fear was a huge motivation in Washington to bailing out the auto industry. The fear of what would happen if GM went into what they call an uncontrolled bankruptcy, mm-hmm. without sufficient credit or loan money from an outside source to restructure. My guess is that General Motors would have been broken up and sold off. We'll never know. But the fact is, the enterprise was at stake in General Motors' case. Chrysler could have gone either way. There was even discussion about folding Chrysler into GM or turning Chrysler over to Ford or anything to sort of, you know, keep their plants alive, but maybe not the company itself. But a failure by GM would have had a ripple effect, particularly on the supplier community, and probably caused a lot of shutdowns across the country, not just in the domestic automakers, but some of the Japanese automakers who share suppliers as well. So it was a pivot point on whether or not the country could withstand whatever the fallout was from a GM failure and liquidation. And that would have been a huge, I don't know what the numbers are, it's all speculative, but it would have been a huge number of jobs that would have been lost. And given the state of the economy at the time, I believe that the bet was on, let's try and fix this thing rather than take our chances with letting it fail.
Tom Perriello, what about the dealerships that were closed in the deal? GM and Chrysler ceased relations with about 2,000 dealers, and one estimate puts that at about 50 employees per dealership. Not all of them closed. Some of them just changed what they were selling. But what about those kinds of jobs?
Well, you know, we've seen a lot of different parts of the auto sector, some of which have grown. In some places, there's been consolidation. You know, when General Motors was coming to the table, they had to come with a plan of exactly how they were going to make the decisions to get competitive again. And this was, you know, there was a certain amount of saying, okay, the government's not going to micromanage and make those decisions like with the dealers. That was not their decision. That was the GM coming to them with a plan. But it was also true that representing the taxpayers, they weren't going to come in and say we're simply throwing money at the problem. I think to understand how bold of a move this was and how successful it was, this was not something where it was like we just need to inject cash into the system to save these companies. This was a restructuring of the companies, including some things both on the union side and the management side that were probably long overdue, where there were lots of redundancies and other things. So these were difficult decisions that were made, you know, and now it's a little bit like when, you know, you're watching football and there's a fourth down and two and you kind of want them to go for it or not go for it, and then as soon as they get the first down, everyone's like, oh, I was totally for them going for it. And I think this goes to Bill's point about just how much people thought it was too risky of a move at the time. But I think it also goes back a little bit to where you come from. And you think about President Obama being in South Side of Chicago when steel mills were shutting down, or, you know, what Joe Biden saw in terms of Scranton and other places. And you see, when you lose jobs like this, it's not just the jobs themselves. It's the small businesses around it where people are going to the diner or doing their shopping or other things. And the ripple effect of that is really devastating. We saw in Southern Virginia this with textiles and furniture. And so I think their gut instinct was, this is too important in terms of the ripple effects not to go for that fourth down and two. And I do think Governor Romney took a different approach. His experience from Bain had been, when you see kind of a weak company, you figure out how to break it up for parts, and that, you know, you can make that argument from a profit maximization standpoint. They took different decisions on that fourth down and two, and I think most people across the Midwest and other parts of the country feel like the president made the right call.
Casey in Cleveland, you disagree. Welcome to the show.
Yeah, well, certainly I disagree. First of all, Tom, of course, he works for a propaganda Democratic Action Committee. So whatever he's saying is tilted toward
Well, Tom, Democrats. Why don't we just talk about, we've had a different point of view on as well besides what Tom Perriello has to say. Why don't we just stick with the topic?
Okay, well, first of all, I've heard you say the auto industry, but isn't it a fact that we're talking about General Motors and Chrysler? Ford didn't take the bailout. That's correct?
That is correct in terms of the bailout, but not in terms of the industry. The CEO of Ford has spoken very specifically about the fact that this would have had significant impacts on Ford, on the suppliers, on others. So, no, we really are talking, I think, about the whole auto industry, though, in terms of receiving of the bailout money. And, you know, even if a progressive says 2 plus 2 equals 4, it still equals 4. So, you know, we do want to look at the facts in this case.
Okay. Well, the fact is, like, you know, you mentioned here in Ohio, well, you know, they say 1 out of 8 are employed.
In the auto industry?
Right. Mm-hmm. Correct. That's what they're saying, of course. Here's my point is, okay, that means that the other 7 are carrying the burden of taxes to bail out 1. You know, I mean, hello. And you mentioned the ripple effect. Well, how about the 7 who also support small businesses? Now they're going to have their taxes paying more in tax, which means that they're not spending that money with the small businesses, okay, with the restaurants. The ripple effect.
All right. Well, let's hear what Tom Perriello has to say. Casey,
you got to be concerned about the 7.
Thanks for your call.
Thanks for the comment, and I am more than happy to have these two arguments presented to people across Ohio, mm-hmm, and Chicago. I think people, you know, whether they're in the auto industry or not, feel glad, a majority, that this was an industry that was saved. You're also looking, I talked about the $97 billion in personal income to those folks who are obviously paying taxes in, as well as spending money, another $7.2 billion that would have had to be spent on unemployment, Social Security, and other benefits. So again, I mean, I think you can look at that and say, okay, this is a taker-maker thing, or you can look at it and say this is a significant part of the economy. These are folks who want to work hard and play by the rules and pay into the system. And again, that's what public debates are for. I feel like this was a good decision that has positive impacts, not just on those working directly in the auto industry, but those in the communities around them. And, you know, again, that's what public debates are for.
All right, Casey, thanks a lot for that call. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News, and we're talking with Tom Perriello of the Center for American Progress Group's Action Fund, and also with us, Bill Vlasic, author and Detroit bureau chief for The New York Times. Bill Vlasic, there is disagreement across the country about this, but the polling has shown that Americans generally favor it. What about in Detroit? Is there any disagreement over this in the Detroit area at all?
Well, there's always disagreements, I think, you know, depending on political, you know, opinions. I'm sort of apolitical on the topic. I covered it as a reporter. I must say the summer of 2009, that whole year, in fact, was very grim around here. I often say I went months where I don't think a day went by that I didn't meet somebody who had just lost their job for some connection to the auto industry. So Detroit was and has been dependent on this industry for a long, long time. And if GM and Chrysler had disappeared, Detroit would have certainly been impacted, and this whole state of Michigan and throughout the Midwest. That being said, you know, there's a lot of interest groups and a lot of people that are involved in this industry who felt a lot of pain through this process. You can talk about the union, but many, many thousands of union jobs disappeared. And in fact, right now, with two-tier wages, ironically, the highest-paid auto workers in the country work for GM, and so do the lowest, because the entry-level wages at General Motors are $15 an hour, which are actually below the transplant factories. Union jobs, white-collar jobs, many, many dealership jobs. And, of course, if you're building too many cars that people aren't buying and stacking up in parking lots across the country, maybe you don't need as many dealers to be an efficient company. That was, I think, the goal, and it was a squishy one for the Automotive Task Force. What will make GM successful? Steve Rattner, who was head of the task force, has sort of admitted that maybe they gave them too much money. Maybe they gave GM too much. But that's because they didn't know. They were just drawing a circle, trying to understand how they could fix this thing so it would survive and thrive down the road. So let's err on the side of giving them more money. And just to clear up another point, all the loans to Chrysler and General Motors by the taxpayers have been paid back. It's the equity, the stock holdings, right, that the taxpayers have in GM, which are still at issue. And, you know, that will ultimately resolve itself probably at a loss. But from stepping back, you're going to look at the jobs lost, the changes. I didn't even mention the fact that the entire management team at General Motors is different, completely, totally different. It's like covering a new company as a reporter. Every single senior executive has been replaced since the 08-09 timeframe, and for that matter, at Chrysler as well. So these companies are different now. They are, by most measures, better competitors, which is good for the consumer, that they have more choices and better cars to choose from. But it gets back to that point of, are we better off with or without an auto industry or three auto companies? A lot of people said, well, maybe just if Ford had survived, that would have been enough. Hmm. GM executive once said to me, not too long, well, before the bailout, but not that long ago, what they worried most about at GM was apathy, that Americans wouldn't care whether GM made it or didn't. And why not? We can buy Toyotas and Hondas. We like those. They're good cars. But this whole process, starting with the hearings and through the torturous restructuring of the company, really brought to the forefront, is it important for America to have a functioning, profitable automotive industry? It's important to the Japanese. It's important to the Koreans. It's very important to the Germans. My gosh, they're fighting tooth and nail to save companies like Fiat and Peugeot in Italy and France, because they have no companies, no industries that can replace the kind of capital spending and
right.
hiring. They're just the size alone, and for every, they're not monoliths. They're towns and cities that really do live and die with these companies. And it's not that much different than steel companies were many years ago, or lumber companies or railroad companies. But the fact is, the auto industry, I think, even, you know, those who didn't support the bailout generally and sometimes grudgingly agree that, yes, it is good for America to have functioning, profitable, successful auto companies. We did not have that before this bailout. We certainly didn't have it at General Motors. And if there was another way to do it, maybe that'll be debated for years to come.
Bill Vlasic, thanks for joining us today.
Oh, thank you, Ann. I really appreciate it.
Bill Vlasic, he's author of Once Upon a Car, The Fall and Resurrection of America's Big Three Automakers, GM, Ford, and Chrysler. It's out in paperback now. And Tom Perriello, thanks for joining us as well.
Thank you so much.
Tom Perriello, he's president of the Center for American Progress Group's Action Fund. Thanks to everybody for your calls and your questions. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.